Greetings, cultists. Who wants to live forever? Well, if I had a nickel for every episode of the show we've recorded that featured a movie with a Queen soundtrack where that line comes up, I'd have two nickels, but it's weird that it's happened twice. Now, the Greek philosopher Aristotle famously said, "Wise men speak when they have something to say. Fools speak when they have to say something." I leave you, dear audience, to make your own judgment on which category you feel we fall into here on the show. But regardless, welcome to the final edition of cult classics of this season, and we're going out with not only one of the biggest cult hits of the 80s, but one we've been asked for repeatedly. It's a rock-fueled fantasy epic featuring one of the most memorable villains in movies and a sword-wielding former James Bond. And that still doesn't adequately describe just how awesome it is. A movie so legendary that it predicted its legacy within its own tagline. It is the one, the only, Highlander. Now, as ever, I'm your host down through the centuries. Just think of me as the elder statesman, if you will. The Egyptian / Spanish metallurgist with an accent to match. I'm DK, but I do not come alone. I have three of my fellow travellers here with me today. You've heard them all before in the history of our show, so I'll let them introduce themselves.
I am Ian McSanderson of the Clan McSanderson. I was born in the year 1677 in County Mayo, Ireland, and first appeared on the show to talk about Big Trouble in Little China. And I am immortal.
Salve te omnes. I'm Angelica of the House of Grantos, but you may address me as Angela. I was born in Anno Domini 98 in Roma, Italia, and first appeared on the show to talk about the adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. And I am immortal.
I'm Gavin Revitt. I was born in the year 1654 in the realm of Yorkshire. First appeared on the show to talk about the Black Hole. And I am immortal.
Ooh, shivers. So yeah, that's three guests all come for the gathering. We're going to get started on today's movie, which is Highlander, of course. It's a 1986 fantasy action adventure directed by Russell Mulcahy from a screenplay by Gregory Wyden, Peter Bellwood, and Larry Ferguson. Stars Christopher Lambert, Roxanne Hart, Clancy Brown, and Sean Connery. The film chronicles the climax of an age-old war between immortal warriors, depicted through interwoven past and present-day storylines. Originally called The Dark Knight, filming took place in Scotland, England, Wales, and New York, and opened in LA on March 7, 1986. The film grossed $2.4 million on its opening weekend and ended with $5.9 million in the US, grossing $12.9 million worldwide against a production budget of $19 million. So, yeah. Didn't go down well. It received mixed to negative reviews upon its release, with Variety claiming that while it contained entertaining moments, the total piece is a mess. It was not well received, it's safe to say. Nevertheless, over the decades, it's gained wide and persistent popularity, especially in Europe and on home video, and commands a loyal cult following. The tagline, "There can be only one," has cemented itself into pop culture lexicon, and its increasing allure has led to several sequels, though we don't really like to talk about them, a television series and spin-offs, including an animated series and a reboot, which is currently in production. And as with our other cult classics, Highlander can currently be found, depending on where you're located, on different streaming services and on physical media, should that be your preferred option. Now, I never saw this one in cinemas, and my first experience of this was when I was given it as a Christmas gift in the late 80s. There was a glut of releases around that time, where studios were cottoning on to the fact that the home video market was a gold mine. The reduction in price of VHS players on the market around that time made it an essential purchase for most homes, and distributors were rushing to cash in on anything and everything, really, in their catalogue that would make them a profit. I received mostly video cassettes for Christmas that year. I remember getting Nightmare on Elm Street, House, Life of Brian, Fright Night, and this, Highlander. Now, unlike the rest of the gifts, I'd never seen this one before. But a relative picked it up for me thinking it would be my sort of thing. And I've got to say they were right. It took about a week to get around to watching it, but I'd pretty much fallen in love with that beautifully painted cover already. Even so, I was pretty unsure about watching it in case it turned out to be awful. Luckily, to me at least, back then, it wasn't. And then shortly afterwards, ended up with a 6-foot poster of that painted cover on my bedroom ceiling a few months later. Yeah, I'm coming to you guys now. What were your first experiences with this one? I'll come to you first on this one, Ian.
So my first sort of exposure to this was through the Queen soundtrack. It wasn't via the film. I didn't know anything about the film at the time, but my dad was big into Queen, and this was one of the, I think it was It's a Kind of Magic, you know, the actual album that featured a few of the tracks from the Highlander soundtrack that I then got and thought, this is pretty good. I mean, you know, then checked out the movie on VHS, probably early 90s, and liked it since then, really.
Cool. Angela, what about you?
Can't honestly remember how or when I first saw it, apart from, I know it wasn't in a cinema. I think it was either on TV, probably at Christmas, as I used to watch a load of things back then. I do actually have a copy on VHS somewhere.
Yeah, oh well, I'm going to say I stand out amongst us all then. I did actually see this at the cinema when it first came out. My dad was kind enough to take me to go and see it. I was intrigued myself because I've been a Queen fan, obviously, my whole life. So having seen Flash Gordon and loving that for having its soundtrack by Queen, all of a sudden along came another film, and that I think I might have found out about it as a result of the Queen soundtrack and them being involved with the project at first, which is kind of what brought it to my attention, because obviously back then there was no internet, no social media, so you found out these things however you did. And I absolutely loved it. In terms of the story, just the sheer concept as well, the sort of emotional depth that there was to it, you know, and sort of looking at the sort of shadier side of immortality, you know, where something like that might be something that everybody would sort of appeal to. There was a real sort of melancholy that came across, you know, from the way that they made it, and that kind of appealed to me as well. Appealed to the teenage me, which would be about right.
Well, has your impression of this movie changed since the first time you watched it? And I'll come to you first on this one, Angela.
Yeah, I remember absolutely loving it when I was younger. But looking back at it earlier on today, there are lots of inconsistencies and things that I'm sort of picking out. Plus the whole, why is there a Scotsman playing an Egyptian Spaniard? And a Frenchman playing a Scotsman.
I love it. I just love this.
What?
Yeah. What about you, Gavin?
Yeah, it's kind of lost a little bit of edge, but I think that's perhaps only interestingly sort of in the style, in the way that it was done. But having said that, I'm a big admirer of Russell Mackay. I didn't sort of twig his background until I looked into it. He came from a background of doing a lot of music videos, didn't he?
Yeah.
Sorry, Russell, I didn't even realise that you were Australian. So that was an interesting one just to be thrown in. But he did, one of the first bands that he did any music for was a music video for was AC/DC. He went through a whole bunch of them in the 80s, including Talk Talk, Joy Division, I think, was in there as well. So, Duran Duran as well, I think. So he's had some really good sort of practice like that. He's kind of come into the music industry through music videos in a similar fashion to where Ridley Scott came through with advertisements, didn't he? So it's interesting to look at the editing style and think, you know, something in me thinks that perhaps a lot of the brilliant edits that happened, you know, the transitions that happened in the film, came from that sort of staple background of having worked on pop videos. Because a lot of that kind of seems to filter into some of the work that he did there as well.
There are some good points. I'm thinking specifically that opening scene where it zooms over Madison Square Garden to Connor with that wrestling match interspersed with the battle. Apparently it was a computerized system that held the camera on four wires. I've just got to give credit. It was invented by the inventor of the Steadicam, Garrett Brown. So
I think that was a really
good opening shot. Although I do have to say that I kind of think Russell Mackay might have shot his bolt with this one, because after that it's less than stellar. I've got to be honest, and no offence to you if you're listening, Russell, but, you know, again, why would you be? It's, you know, he went from, he then followed this up with Highlander 2, and I think, you know, I'm sure we'll come to that at some point. He then did The Shadow, which, I don't know, not bad, and he did a TV movie called The Curse of King Tut's Tomb. I don't know if any of you guys have seen that.
Never seen it.
No, not seen that.
No. Yeah, my review for that was basically he couldn't decide whether it wanted to be The Mummy or Raiders of the Lost Ark, so ended up settling on Birdemic. It is... Well, it's not good. We'll put it that way. Yeah. It's not good.
Yeah. I will stand up in one corner, though, and give him a little bit of support for Highlander 2, though, because there was the Renegade version, which clawed it back a little bit.
Not enough, mate.
Just, oh, not God. Much. I didn't say clone it back by much, but there was, you know, it was kind of unfortunate, I guess, wouldn't it, really? It's, mind you, Highlander itself can be considered a bit of a one-shot deal, really, can't it? I found it interesting that they tried to do sequels or stories around it, you know.
Because, I mean, it did so
really
well.
You really only do prequels, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it didn't do well in the cinema. But the popularity that it gained over the years, it did so well that the studio, you know, automatically thought, oh, cha-ching, let's get another sequel out there. What I can't understand is why they didn't learn their lesson kind of from that. And
sometimes they'll just keep pushing something, won't they? Keep trying to wring the sponge out, won't they? Just to try and get something, which is unfortunate.
So what about you, Ian? Has your impression of this changed since the first time that you watched it?
Only from... maybe a few inconsistencies, and for me personally, when I've watched it recently, the movie only really starts when Sean Connery comes into it.
Mm.
You know, apart from that, the sort of stuff at the beginning seems like it would just hash together quickly just to try and get the main sort of story out there. You still weren't quite fully grasping it until he comes into it and explains what's going on. But, you know, visually, some bits are still pretty good. Some bits are obviously dated, but... still pretty good movie, still holds up as a decent movie, like, and but it does end, like, so for an ending to Highlander 2, where it was a sequel, didn't make any sense. Now, a prequel it would have made more sense. They could have just done the adventures of them two and sort of ended it coming up to Highlander 1, so they go, like, you know what I mean? They could have done it that way.
Yeah, certainly sounds like it could have been fun following Connor McLeod and Castigar.
Well, they got so many things in history to choose from, you know, because they went through our, you know, 1500s to sort of present day then.
It like Bill Edge just without the phone booth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. See, what I like about this, going back to kind of what Angela brought up with the casting, is that. By all standards, it really shouldn't work whatsoever.
No,
I mean, you got, you know, as we say, the actors completely kind of in the wrong part. I mean, apparently Christopher Lambert, he couldn't speak English right up until filming.
Wow.
And
I mean, I only knew of Christopher Lambert from Luc Besson. He was the weird-looking guy with the strip light on the front of Subway. That was pretty much all I knew of Christopher Lambert. Well, I think he did a perfectly good job with Connor. I was, you know, in spite of the fact that, as you said, that, you know, they could have had somebody Scottish playing the part, and they went with somebody who wasn't Scottish. I thought he did all right.
When you consider some of the names that they were looking at, amongst the actors considered for the role of Connor, were Michael Douglas, Ed Harris, Sam Shepard, David Keith, Kevin Costner, Scott Glenn, Sting, who was also considered at one point to provide the soundtrack for the movie, Mickey Rourke, Peter Weller, Mel Gibson, and William Hurt. And it was eventually offered to an actor, and you'll find this interesting, Ian, it was eventually offered to Kurt Russell.
Wow.
Oh,
really?
He was cast, but then pulled out during pre-production at the insistence of his girlfriend Goldie Hawn. Why? We do not know. Instead, and as I said, mate, you'll find this interesting, he took the role of Jack Burton in Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, there you go. Every clown.
Right, there we go, yeah.
Yeah, falling dominoes everywhere. Yeah.
William Hurt would have been an interesting one.
Yeah, I could never take to William Hurt. I don't think he's got that charisma that maybe Christopher Lambert has.
I would probably like to have seen Mel Gibson. because he's an interesting one.
Oh, I was going to say, he had another Scottish one entirely, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You could
just imagine the fever dreams of people getting those two films mixed up.
Yeah, that was his Highlander, wasn't it?
Yeah.
As far as Ramirez goes, people in the running, Lee Van Cleef, Clint Eastwood, Malcolm McDowell, Gene Hackman, Michael Caine, and Peter O'Toole were considered.
You're only supposed to chop his bloody head off.
So, yeah, I mean, all of Connery's scenes had to be filmed in a week due to Connery's schedule. He had a bet, apparently, with director Russell Mulcahy that they wouldn't finish in 7 days. But really? Mulcahy won the bet, and Connery ended up earning $1 million just for a week's work.
Wow.
Nice.
That's a rush job then, isn't it?
It is. And speaking of, the opening preamble, the opening voiceover by Connery with that echo effect, it was recorded on the phone in the bathroom of his Spanish villa.
Fantastic. That's why he's a Spaniard.
Yeah, it was played for producers.
It's all starting to make more sense, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. It was played for producers over the phone, and they approved of it because, obviously, with it being on the phone, they couldn't discern the quality of the recording.
Wow, that's hilarious.
That's brilliant, yeah. And it's really good reverb as well, I think.
It is. It really works. Although, going back to what you said, Angela, I mean, the fact that Ramirez sounds Scottish, even though he's supposed to be Egyptian, apparently Scottish mythology claims Gaels, the Scottish people, descend from an Egyptian princess named Scota. Since Ramirez was born apparently before Christ, it's plausible he could be part of the Egyptians that came with Scota. But I think at that point you're kind of leaning heavily into headcanon to get away with discrepancies. Yeah, I mean, how do you think Lambert did with regards to the role?
Yeah, I think he did well with it, particularly if he had no idea about English up to that point. I think he did very well. The one thing that I always remember was that kind of look that he did have in his eyes, though. He did have, you know, the thing that put Garfield off when they were interviewing him after the fight with Fazil.
Yeah.
The way he just looked through Garfield's soul, it was just... They definitely got that with his eyes well, you know.
But do you know why? This is another thing. Do you know why?
Another one. Oh, go on.
Christopher Lambert has an ocular degenerative thing. He's practically blind, and you couldn't really see very well.
Really?
So, right. You're blind.
Yeah, that intense stare is pretty much just Christopher Lambert trying to make the fuck out of whatever was around him.
And looking through people's souls at the same time. That's
yeah. All of these like disparate elements that would pretty much hobble any other production all seem to have kind of added to the mythos around this, and I loved that. Talk about happy accidents, as Bob Ross would say. It's all combined to make this, you know, cult classic, when for the most part any single one of these things would have gone, oh god, that was a bad decision.
I will also put my hand up as well with Clancy Brown. I think he played an excellent villain. I think he pulled that part off excellently. I mean, he's taken his fair share of sort of boisterous characters over the years with the likes of Starship Troopers and things like that. But as Kurgan, I think he was absolutely fantastic. He brought a real sort of solid, no-nonsense kind of character, you know. I mean, a little bit sort of cardboard cutout-ish, which could be a little bit, you know, like that, because effectively they've got him as this sort of crafted sort of straight die-cast sort of villain, you know. There didn't have to be a lot of depth to him in that sense, I don't think, because, you know, the whole essence of the thing is a good versus evil, so just take the guy and paint him as dark as you like, you know, and give him that edge. But I think he played the part very well, you know. He gave it a little sort of sternness as well, you know, outside the melodramatic sort of qualities that he brought to it. And I've enjoyed his acting as a result of that. I think this was the first thing I saw him in.
Yeah, I think this kind of put him on the map. He'd obviously been in, you know, projects before, but I think that's when people began to sit up and take notice.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, in a 2021 interview, he stated that he received no salary. Yeah, he was apparently offered the part after Schwarzenegger turned it down. The producers felt that the experience of working with Sean Connery was payment enough. In an interview, he's described the producers of the film as buzzards and scavengers who didn't pay him any form of compensation, and I mean, you know, not even residuals for his role, and instead gave the pay that he should have received to Sir Sean because he was a bigger name actor. Apparently, he was, with regards to his character, yeah, he's very dark, but apparently he was so nice on set. He was a big teddy bear, apparently.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it says, after filming the scene where he confronts McLeod in the church, Clancy Brown went and apologised individually to the priest and nuns for his character's dialogue, for here he offended them. And when it came to the, you know, the scene where he like busts down the door of the castle and Ramirez and Heather are there, he was apparently really nervous when it came to share a scene with Sean Connery. He was supposed to rush in, slice the table in half, and then engage Ramirez in battle. Apparently, he instead took a swing at the candelabra and nearly decapitated Connery on the spot.
Oh my God.
Connery reportedly stormed off the set in anger, and Clancy Brown just began to apologise profusely. They eventually made it up, though, and Connery joked that he should just use his stunt double more.
Yeah.
So it does sound, it sounds like a fantastic little production there.
Yeah, so that's wild, that. You really don't want to be killing James Bond, do you?
Exactly. But apparently, according to Lambert and Mulcahy, Connery was often drunk while filming in Scotland. Mulcahy says, we shot fast in Scotland, London and New York. The budget was just 30 million, so it's a guerrilla-style filmmaking. When we were in Glencoe, the producer had to run down the mountain with a pocket of change to call the studio from a phone box. On the plane up, Sean brought out a bottle of homemade scotch a friend had given him. Come on, laddie, he said, have a nip of this, and it blew my brains out.
Don't surprise me.
No, no. But apparently he wasn't the only one. Those opening scenes of the battle between warring clans, they would obviously shoot, they would have break for lunch, and they would then get back into it. Apparently the extras were a little too enthusiastic. The extras' lunch, how can we put this? They would have, on more often than not, a liquid lunch in which an excessive consumption of alcohol was had, and many would return to the set completely wasted. Then they were given weapons and told to make the battles convincing. Many of them apparently were students from Glasgow University, and the only reason that they were recruited because they had long hair. Their on-set shenanigans apparently were so bad that it necessitated the presence of a medical team to deal with the continual accidents that took place during filming.
God. I'm not going to look at that same scene twice again when they have that real battle head under the water. That's probably why it looks so damn good.
Yes.
Right. It's very authentic, having like Scotsmen going out and drinking.
Oh, yeah.
So is there anyone that stands out for you with regards to the acting in this?
If we ignore the accents, yes, Christopher Lambert did an excellent job as the Highlander. You can tell that his words were dubbed afterwards, you know, when he'd obviously learnt English a bit better. But yes, I definitely think he embodied the spirit of the Highlander.
I mean, Clancy Brown himself, he's obviously a standout actor as he is. So I think he was probably the most professional one on set, if it sounds in it.
I don't know what you mean.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I enjoyed Sean Connery's turn as well. I thought he did a fine job with what he did, because again, he was bringing a certain sort of gravitas through the character of Ramirez. The way he was, you know, I mean, he was clearly very old as well. I mean, how old was he? He'd been alive for about 2,000 years, hadn't he? 2,500 years. And he brought a similar sort of gravitas to it as well, you know, in the similar way that Chris Lambert brought that sort of melancholy to it, you know, everything that when he was telling him, giving him the whole speech about, you know, thinking about leaving Heather, you know, basically the immortals can't really have happy relationships, you know, and it doesn't turn out all sweet, you know, then it's...
Yeah.
There's one bit that does confuse me, though, after watching it recently. It's like the bit where Kurgan comes to the castle to get Connor, or obviously he's not there. Like, where's he gone? at that point.
He popped out for a pint of milk.
Literally. He must have gone to the next village along because he's just like, where's he gone? And then he comes back and he's back there again. But I'm like, where did he go?
Yeah, no, villages are far and few between.
So, yeah, I think like Ian said, don't get me wrong, I love Christopher Lambert. And it, as you said, Gavin, it is quite a melancholic portrayal. Mm. I think the film starts to become a bit more fun once Ramirez turns up.
Yeah.
And I think, he's only got a limited presence, but I think Sean Connery steals pretty much every scene that he's in.
Yeah.
I
have to agree with that.
The good thing about Highlander is it's not got an extensive cast, as it were. I mean, you've got really four main players, Connor, Brenda, Ramirez and Kurgan. What do you think? What did you guys think to Brenda, actually? Roxanne Hart?
Brenda. Brenda played the part perfectly well. I mean, it's difficult with a character such as hers, I think, to be able to sort of sink your teeth into it much. I mean, she's kind of pretty much a foil for the audience a little bit, I think, in that sense, just kind of uncovering the mystery of it a little bit more. But I think she did a perfectly good job with it.
Yeah, I would like them to have made her character a little bit more headstrong, though, because she just ended up being a little bit like the other one, who just like sat in the corner squealing while everything's going on.
Yeah, that's what I didn't like. Obviously, they made her intelligent. She's written this book. She's a scientist, you know, studies swords and metallurgy. And then there's the whole misogynistic bit where Connor says, "Can you cook?" And basically invites herself down for tea. And she doesn't say, "No, cook yourself."
Yeah. If any females that I knew, someone said that to them, they would have got short shrift.
Yeah.
Apparently, Tanya Roberts was offered that role and then turned it down to be in View to a Kill.
I was going to say she was in View to a Kill, wasn't she? Right, she turned that down for that, did she? Right.
Yeah. So turning one Bond down for another.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but what I was going on with earlier with regard what I do like about the writing in this, and I think it's kind of unique to the movies that were in general made back then, is that it gives you a little exposition, but it doesn't try to fill everything in. It's like, if I can compare it to something more popular, the original Star Wars trilogy. It gives you enough so that you go away asking questions, maybe coming up with your own theories, but it doesn't feel the need to set things down in concrete, as it were. It gives the audience that kind of... It doesn't treat them like idiots. Yeah, I mean, I just wondered what you guys thought of that. Were you... The first time you watched it, were you kind of on board, or were you constantly going, well, hang on?
Well, I mean, the thing itself is literally almost a kind of an inverted time travel, isn't it, in terms of the fact that you're dealing with somebody who is so old. So, I mean, there'd be a lot of time to sort of fill in between all of that as well. Anyway, I guess when you're dealing with a character that's lived as long as he has and done the things that he's probably done, there's going to be an awful lot of, not really padding, but, you know, there's going to be a certain sort of amount of buffer to a story where you could probably not be too critical at, you know, being able to sort of explain away the fact that, oh, you know, it was probably something over that period of time that could explain why his character thinks that way or feels that way or does what he does. Leaving a lot of the exposition out and leaving a lot of gaps like that can kind of give you an opportunity to sort of give a bit of a wide berth to things that you can just kind of enjoy filling in.
Yeah, I think the flashback scenes very well for sort of just giving you a little bit of background to why Connor is doing things or thinking things in a particular way in the modern setting.
I do like the fact, though, that they don't say, this is why we're immortal, this is why we're fighting. It glosses over all that, and it just dumps you right into the middle of it, and you're left with the questions, how did this all kick off? And it doesn't feel the need to explain that until, you know, the one that followed.
Well, I guess it's a little bit like that as well, though, with the characters themselves, isn't it? I mean, they'll each have absolutely no clue as to why they're immortal and what's happening to them, will they? You know, so, I think that's a nice kind of fourth wall thing, isn't it, that we get to experience that same mystery as to where it all came from in the first place, you know?
Yeah. The screenwriter, Gregory Wyden, he apparently was inspired to write the story while visiting Scotland on holiday. He was visiting a museum in Edinburgh and came across a suit of armour and wondered what it would have been like, you know, if the man who wore the armour was alive today. So
nice.
Well, that might explain the melancholy.
It could well be.
I would imagine if you were living for certainly as long as Ramirez did, you know, you're gonna have seen a lot, heard a lot, and experienced a lot to the point where if you're as old as Ramirez was, you basically watched sort of, you know, hundreds of generations pass away and, you know, be born and die. You'll see the repetitiveness in humankind and everything that we do and everything that we keep getting wrong all the time. You can imagine that's going to take its toll, isn't it?
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, there was a scene filmed that kind of went on with regards to that. Kurgan fights an immortal in an office building. You don't see the immortal in the final cut, in which this immortal works as a security guard. And the fight pretty much ends when the other guy, he refuses to pick up his sword, saying that he's just done with the fight and he just wants peace and he just allows Kurgan to behead him. And, yeah, it was apparently due to go in, but the footage ended up in a fire and was destroyed.
Oh, damn.
Speaking of Kurgan, I mean, Mulcahy, he originally intended for that final battle with Kurgan to go on longer. His original vision was for an animated dragon to appear in the shape of the helmet that the Kurgan wore at the start of the film. It was supposed to challenge MacLeod as an ultimate test that he was unprepared for, and only after defeating it would the final prize become his. Unfortunately, the budget ran out.
And you could tell by the animation of that in that scene that the budget was definitely gone, basically. It looked like some stupid cartoon animation, you know, with the winds whipping around them.
I kind of like that, and I like the fact that they were just using it to disguise the strings. It wasn't entirely successful. And
I was watching actually that final fight scene, and aside from getting a new perspective on it with what you're saying about Lambert's eyesight, so it's, I think they probably had a stunt double in that particular scene where it's all in silhouette. But yeah, just watching the animation in that, I thought Slimer was going to come out of somewhere. It just really smacked of Ghostbusters with all the sort of spirits whipping around him.
Ghostbusters effects were brilliant for the time.
I'm going to say there's a little bit of trivia as well. MacLeod's museum is his workplace. Is literally about sort of the two or three blocks around the corner from the Ghostbusters HQ.
There you go then. Ties it in there, doesn't it?
So what we need is a Ghostbusters Highlander crossover.
Yeah. Oh.
I'm sure it's been done. I've been looking into some crossovers recently, and my God, the amount of crossovers that there's been with disparate franchises that you would never think is going to happen. And
weird. Yeah.
There is one thing that kind of, so like, in the opening sort of sequence in Madison Square Garden when he's fighting that guy in the garage parking garage thing. When he first like appears, this guy, you think, oh, he's just like a bit of an old man. He's like, oh, having a battle. Next minute, he's backflipping down Central.
Aye.
And I'm like, where's that come from?
He's a bit energetic, that dude, isn't he? Yeah. Jesus. If as my dad said when he watched it, I want whatever butcher that fella's got.
At first he's like, oh, I can't really do this sword fighting. And next minute, he's doing that.
Well, apparently the guy that played him, I forget his name, so excuse me, he was the head stunt coordinator on the movie. So,
there you go then.
I mean, I'm a big proponent of practical effects. Going back to that animation that, you know, that Angela were mentioning, maybe it's because I just grew up in that period and the majority of my favourite kind of movies are around that time. It didn't really make any kind of difference to me. I mean, when it with regards to the effects in this, do you guys have any opinions?
They just are what they are. I mean, end of day, they were on a slim budget after paying him $1 million. So what can you do?
Yeah, it was genuinely pretty good though. You know, I think they spent the budget such as it was fairly wisely.
Yeah.
At the end of the first fight, I certainly remember I was surprised at the time that they didn't shy away from McLeod's beheading of Fazil. Mm. That still looks impressive now. You know, yeah.
All the beheading ones are pretty decent. I mean, they don't really. Mm. They are quite brutal if you think about it like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, again, this comes back to the era of practical effects, doesn't it? Doing something like that,
that's
it has a little bit of a feel to it that smacks of The Thing, you know, in the way that they just sort of took that, you know, the grisly aspect of it and just not shy away from it, which, you know, I guess that kind of surprised me at the time. But,
I mean, there's not an overabundance, and when there is an overabundance, it's not altogether brilliant, as you know, as Angela pointed out, and it doesn't entirely hold the strings. I can see why they did it, but it doesn't entirely work. I can kind of forgive it for that, just because of the period it's in, and you know, it's never been George Lucas'd, as it were. There are some things in the production design that I do like, the sparking swords while they're clashing, which apparently was attaching a wire to each sword that led down the arm to a car battery. So when one was connected to the other, there was an arc.
There were actual literal practical effects then for that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Right.
The one thing that I'm not maybe so keen on, and if you're an animal lover, maybe tune out for, you know, a minute or so, the stag scene. At the time of filming, all stags had lost their horns. So they decided to glue on some antlers.
Oh, right.
Yeah, a vet put the animal to sleep for a little while, and the horns were glued on, and then they had to wait for it to reawaken. But apparently all the deer wanted to do when it woke up was shake off the antlers. And and then during filming, it ran away and never came back. I hasten to add, it was found later, 25 miles away, but without the horns. Some of that stag scene is National Geographic stock footage.
Yeah.
Right. So, but yeah, I don't know. I like the production design on this. Practical effects are always a winner with me. Even, I don't know why, but even when they're kind of ropey, I'm immediately more inclined to forgive them than, say, CG.
Yeah, well, they were going to say CG done badly, I think, just turns out even worse somehow, doesn't it? Whereas practical effects, you know, you can imagine the amount of love and attention and care that probably went into that.
It brings us up, actually, to one of the most important things, and I think one of the reasons that people find this so memorable, and it's the soundtrack. Despite a mention in the end credits today, a complete soundtrack for Highlander, it's never been released, well, officially. First of all, Michael Kamen, who's just fantastic. I mean, you know, Dead Zone, Brazil, Die Hard, Lethal Weapon, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Event Horizon, Iron Giant, X-Men, Band of Brothers. This guy is just, or was.
Pretty much every film in the 80s and 90s, I think.
Phenomenal. And I think the orchestral score for this is beautiful.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yes, listened to it many a time.
Yeah.
But then you've got Queen, and I just think with a Queen soundtrack, it just takes it to like another level.
It's just perfection, I think.
Yeah, I was happy with how enthusiastic they were about it, because I think the only way he only wanted them to maybe do one or two, didn't he? And Freddie decided he was going to put his stamp on about four or five of them.
Yeah, apparently they wanted him to record just one song, but after viewing footage from the movie, they were like,
all in.
I think if it wasn't for that soundtrack, the film wouldn't be as memorable.
Yeah,
you know? Definitely. No, I think with the fact that, you know, you have generations listening to a kind of magic album.
Yeah.
And drawing that line between that and that movie, I think that still draws people towards that movie. Do you have a favourite song from the soundtrack?
Probably Princes of the Universe, to be honest. I think between that and Give Me the Prize, those are the two real sort of harder sort of bangers, I think, that came out of that.
Give Me the Prize and Who Wants to
Live. Freddie's voice has always been phenomenal, but I mean, it really sounds like he's putting his heart and soul into the tracks that appeared in that. You can hear his enthusiasm, I think.
What about you, Angela?
Well, I think that Highlander and Queen are the prime example of when you're using modern music against a period backdrop where it actually works. Yeah, I think Queen definitely ranked the film up much higher than it would have been originally because it's given it a more emotional connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You think it wouldn't have been as kind of popular in cult films if it wasn't for that soundtrack?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to say I tend to agree. I think it probably has, well, I mean, it certainly hasn't hurt it, but I think, yeah, it probably brought the film a lot more attention. Certainly didn't hurt it, but yeah, I mean, it had some phenomenal songs out of that. And I mean, Who Wants to Live Forever? How brilliant a song is that?
Yeah.
You know, in terms of cutting to the heart of the whole, you know, thing with McLeod as well, you know what I mean? It really does kind of amp that up. I think, you know, it's a beautiful song.
It can be a hard listen, I think, yeah. that song. Yeah. I'll always go for Princes of the Universe over that because as beautiful as the song is, it really gets to the heart of things. And
yeah.
I'm not sure I'm always up for that kind of emotion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the scenes in the film kind of hit home as you get older more than they used to. As well,
yeah, definitely. Yeah, I noticed that on this watch.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting watching McLeod and Heather.
I honestly think the character of Heather would have been spot on if not for that screaming yeah. in the castle. That was just.
Tend to focus more on her stubbornness.
Yes,
a sort of willful Scottish lass. She brought that edge quite nicely. I think when she had the chance to shine with that.
Yeah. Yeah, good shout out to BT Edney for that because I think she did play that role really well.
Definitely, yeah.
So, yeah, it brings us to the legacy of this thing. Now, obviously, this was originally a standalone film and a flop at that, but it had become such a big cult hit over the years that the studio decided to cash in by producing a sequel. So, yeah, be careful of what you wish for, folks. I did mention earlier that I was obsessed by Highlander. For a number of years. So when the sequel was announced, I was naturally excited for it. I went out, bought the soundtrack as soon as it was available, bought the poster, had it pride of place on my wall, bought my tickets for the opening day at the cinema so I won't miss out, and then I went and saw it. And people, I cannot stress enough that if you're one of the lucky few that's seen this original and haven't seen the sequel, then I implore you, for the sake of your own well-being, just don't. So yeah, with regards to the legacy, what have you paid it much attention over the years, or are there aspects that you like, or did you kind of tune out after this one?
I watched Highlander 2, but I cannot honestly remember a single thing about it. It was that awesome.
I think that's PTSD.
Yeah.
Well, it could be that as well. And I do remember the series with, was it Adrian Paul?
It was, yeah.
I saw a few episodes of that, but yeah, it just didn't hit home like the original film did.
Yeah, yeah. They certainly feel like a standalone. It doesn't feel like it, like we said, you know, you could do prequels, but it really doesn't feel like the kind of thing that you could expand upon beyond the end of the film. You know, I thought the notion of bringing another sort of planet and trying to explain the immortality kind of thing into the original release of Highlander 2 just kind of, yeah, that didn't sit right at all. Yeah, yeah, like going back to what you were saying, man, about the unexpressed, unexplained, the mystery, you know, the sort of keeping a certain sort of obscurity to the details so that you could fill them in for yourself or just feel it out how you wanted to, I think.
Yeah,
I think that's the strength of the original film.
Yeah,
as it stands, and it's a film very much of its era, but I think it's got a real nice sort of human quality behind it, which I guess kind of separates the story somewhat from the effects as well. You know, it makes the effects less. It's not really an effects driven film. You know, it's very much a personal kind of story, I think, you know, which is why I think it works as a movie in itself, you know, irrespective of how it performed at the box office, you know.
Cool. What about you, Ian? Did you bother with any of the sequels or the TV show?
I remember kind of liking the TV show when it was on, but you know, I mean, it was never brilliant. And when they kind of did the crossover thing, it was a little bit strange. Highlander 2, just weird. I mean, I don't know why. I mean, Sean Connery comes back and he's dressed in the same outfit. It's like, what's that about? it's just an imagination. It's like a fever dream, isn't it?
I think Highlander 3 managed a little bit. I don't remember much of that, but I think at least that they set that before the quickening, hadn't they?
It was a little bit like Kurgan, weren't he, the baddie in that? It was a kind of similar character.
I'm trying to remember his name now. Mario Van Peebles.
He was actually all right. I remember him being half decent as kind of a bad guy. He's probably the highlight of Highlander 3.
Yeah, well, that, again, you know, I think three succeeded where two didn't, because I think three was kind of taking a step back to before The Gathering, wasn't it? I think it was a kind of a... I don't think it had taken place after The Gathering, had it, that one? I have to admit, I can't remember. But I get the feeling that it felt much more like it was a kind of a story within the realm that took place before, which kind of made it a bit, you know, well, a lot more acceptable to me as a someone who was following it. So I'd be willing to give three another watch again.
So was three kind of set before the first one, or was it not? Or was it?
Well, in between it all, I think. Yeah, you know, it was sort of fairly present day because he was together with another blonde lass.
Probably had that same hair.
I think it was before Brenda, though. I think it was. I'd be willing to look at the third one. I don't think I've seen... Is there a fourth one? I think there's a fourth.
There's a fourth and a fifth. The fourth is... That crossover that you were on about, Ian.
I was intrigued by it at the time, I think. I've not seen it.
I think the fourth one, it was pretty much Christopher Lambert wanting done with it and then just trying to make way for Adrian Paul to tie it into that continuity.
Right.
Yeah.
They had a lot of the characters back from the first one, but it felt very much a Poundland version to me.
Right.
And the fifth one is just an abomination by all accounts that makes Highlander 2 look like Citizen Kane.
Right. Okay, we'll give that
bad, eh?
Are you guys kind of, I'm not going to say excited, but are you intrigued about this reboot that's in production?
Yeah. This is Henry Cavill, isn't it, that's got the part?
It is, yeah. And apparently it's going to be the Queen soundtrack again.
Okay. Really?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I mean, I don't know. You know, we were talking a bit about this with The Black Hole, weren't we? When we were talking about the possibility of remakes on that and anything like that. I think with it's a similar kind of thing with Highlander, that you'll never lose the love of the original.
No.
Yeah, perhaps what we'll end up with is a Highlander with a bigger budget. Effectively,
who's playing Sean Connery's character? Then that's the question.
It's not been, it's not been revealed.
Hopefully, not The Rock. Yeah,
that's interesting. Who would you have cast as Ramirez if you had the chance? That's an interesting question.
Pedro Pascal.
Interesting.
He's just going to take over the universe.
Yeah, I've asked that question and I've not even got an answer for that myself. I don't know.
Okay, hear me out, but along the lines of Angela's suggestion, Nick Cage.
Kind of would work.
Yes.
Would work, because he's on his little bit of a comeback, isn't he? So he's
Nick Cage, Nick Cage could bring just about anything to a character, can't he? He could be as... Yeah.
He could be a crazy Cage. Egyptian Spaniard.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. What about you, Angela?
I can see Nick Cage doing that. I mean, because he's not afraid of making fun of himself, and Ramirez isn't exactly a serious character.
Yeah,
nice one. Well, we're going to begin. We're going to begin rounding this thing up in a moment. But as is the norm now on this show, before I move on, is there anything of note about the movie that you think we've missed or glossed over, perhaps that you'd like to bring attention to before we do?
Oh, if you ever go to visit the site where they shot this. The opening sequences, the castle. Don't be disappointed. Yes, that's the one. Don't be disappointed. It's terrifyingly close to the A87.
Oh.
So it's right up against the road, really. So you kind of imagine this big sprawling sort of highland thing behind it, and it's not at all as a car park and the road. So it's a beautiful place. Beautiful place, and it's worth a visit as well. It's nice. It's nice around there.
What about you, Ian, Angela? Anything that you want to bring up that you think we might have not coloured before?
Well, I was just amused in the fight scene at Madison Square Gardens. So they're obviously set off sprinklers, but the rain, well, the water wasn't dropping like sprinklers would drop. It was like they were in the middle of a rainstorm. Because, like, normally it just looked like it was just rain coming vertically rather than, you know, with sprinklers, it tends to be more at an angle. That seemed a bit off.
Yeah. What about you, Ian?
No, I mean, I enjoyed the film as it is. It's just, it's a weird one because I kind of think, obviously, I don't remember it when it was at the cinema. And you kind of think when you watch the film, how could it have done so badly? Do you know what I mean? At the time, with it having Queen as the soundtrack and a few actors in it that are obviously well renowned, you just think, how's that failed?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Obviously, maybe it wasn't, advertised.
Well, yeah, that's all I can think. Yeah.
Budget was really bad, like, you know.
So the question, do you think it holds up?
Overall, I would say yes. And I say that, as I say, only because I consider the film to be very much a sort of a personal story. That again, you know, I keep going back to, as we were talking about with the Black Hole, but I treat this film in very much the same way, in that it's got a kind of a line into it, which if you follow that line and you take the film on the premise of that it comes out a lot better than perhaps if you judged it on any other angle, you know. But it's got heart. So yes, overall, on a character basis, I would say for me it stands up.
Cool. Ian?
You know, there can be only one and they should have stuck at that.
They wrote their own legacy, didn't they, with that?
Special effects wise, you know, it's just a movie of its time, really. Like I say, I mean, I personally like the film when Sean Connery appears in it, and that's when the film starts for me. But yeah, it's good all round. Yeah, it's a good watch. You don't get bored watching it, so it's a thumbs up.
Nice. Angela?
Yes, obviously, there are things that we notice now that we maybe didn't when we watched the first time round, like inconsistencies or, you know, like the aging of the effects and things like that. But the story itself remains true. And, you know, it is a good film to watch. I would recommend anybody who hasn't watched it yet should still go out and watch it.
Cool. I mean, it is regarded as a cult, you know, in quotation marks, classic at this point. So, yes or no, do you guys personally think it deserves that?
Yes.
Definitely. Yeah.
Nice one. So, yeah, we're going to go to what the audience thinks of this one shortly. But before we do, I'm going to ask you for your personal highlights, starting with your MVP pick on this one. Anyone you think gave an outstanding performance or a character that was particularly well written? And I'm going to come to you first this time, Angela.
MVP? Yeah, I'm going to have to go with Sean Connery as Ramirez. He just brings just that little extra to the film. Extra in both senses, you know. he just makes the film gel together better.
What about you, Gavin?
I'm going to say I kind of lean a little bit towards Clancy Brown for his sort of understated portrayal of that. But yeah, I'll go with Sean Connery as well, I think, because that sort of self-deferential sort of thing that he has about him is kind of cynicism and but humour as well, you know. He does kind of bring a lot of charisma into the character. You can imagine this guy's been charismatic all the way through the years that he's been doing what he's been doing, can't you? So I think he brings a certain quality to the film that kind of gels it. Yeah, I'll go with that as well.
Nice one. Ian?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think for me, it's got to be Christopher Lambert as Connor, because just think, like, now knowing that he couldn't really see and he did a lot of sword training and whatnot, and it's, you've got to imagine maybe he was out of his depth quite a lot as well with some things. So, but
yeah.
His
own there is a lot to be taken.
Portrayal of Chris as the character well, is quite well.
Yeah.
I'll point out that he trained extensively with British Olympic fencer and sword master Bob Anderson.
Oh.
So I'm going to have to go with Ramirez myself, Sean Connery. He's so personable in this. I just think he makes this movie. As much as I love Lambert and as much as I love Brown, I just think he takes it over the edge. So yeah, we've covered that. We're to some extent we're all fans of this on some level, so that's a given. But what is it about this film that grabs you personally here? Is it the acting, the writing, the soundtrack? I mean, do you have any particular element that for you is just a chef's kiss moment? I mean, something that gives you shivers every time you watch it? I mean, I think of this as that unknown element that connects us with a primal level almost, but, you know, feel free to limit to a technical perspective. And again, we'll go around, so I'll start with you, Angela.
It's the way that they portray the advantages and disadvantages of being immortal. I mean, some people say that, you know, they want to live forever, to quote the Queen's song. While in some respects that might sound like a great thing, when you get down to it, when you watch the people you love die and the whole world changing around you, it can become depressing, I guess, when there's the whole melancholy feel towards it.
What about you, Gavin?
Yeah, I mean, I'll echo that. You know, I think it is the personal side to it. I remember that most when I was watching it in the cinema, that, you know, I got the sense that I was coming into something that was going to be a big sort of adventure. And I mean, it was in many respects, but I was genuinely sort of captivated by that sort of melancholy and the reflection on immortality, you know. And I think it was one of the first films that kind of gave you a little bit of pause for thought as to how it would actually really be. I thought it brought a very similitude. it brings a real sort of sense of realism to the thing. You know, it has a real sort of groundedness, a real believability, and I think that was acted out beautifully. You know, with respect to Sean Connery and his kind of fulcrum sort of character in this. You know, he'd been around a lot longer than McLeod had, and, you know, was trying to kind of explain to him as much as he was trying to teach him against the Kurgan and try and help save mankind from that kind of darkness. At the same time, he had this old, weary soul, you know, and I thought he portrayed that really well. And then I think Christopher Lambert did a really good job of picking that up and, you know, going through the experience of losing Heather and then moving on and going on into the future. And of course him having this push-pull situation with Brenda, where he could kind of feel himself wanting to get back into a relationship and not wanting to be into it again. And Rachel was trying to encourage him and, you know, make him realise that he'd got a vital part of his soul missing in that respect by rejecting it. You know, you can understand that. I think that was really well communicated for a film which ostensibly could have just been an on the surface kind of a, you know, action adventure of immortals battling towards the end of this mission that they were on. So I think that's the core of it for me with Highlander. It's just a beautiful kind of ponderous film.
Ian?
Yeah, I mean, so when I first obviously saw it, I never really got the feely side, you know, the emotional side of it. It was more for the fantasy action, like the unique concept of the film on itself. Mm. Like immortal warriors battling through time. It's pretty cool. And the whole epic scope of it all. So, you know, you've got different continents they visit. So that's kind of what I'm kind of looking forward to for the remake, because they could expand on that even more. You know, give us more periods in time where they probably couldn't show us before. That would be quite cool. And obviously the soundtrack just stands out on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm going to have to go with kind of the soundtrack. I mean, not just the Queen songs, but Cayman's score. And it does make it, for me, all that more emotional. You know, the Connery says it at one point, we are brothers. But when you put those kind of little montages that you see, first of all, where they're training, and then that one in the last scene where he's remembering Ramirez and kind of speaking to him, I just think that's so beautiful with Cayman Scott. And I really do feel like they are brothers. It's got that emotional, and it is kind of shorthand because you don't see that many scenes of them together, but you buy into that relationship, and I love that about this. So yeah, with that out of the way, you guys out there know what our highlights of this one are.
But what about you? Once again, we asked all of you out there in the real world what you thought, and yeah, another stunning response. So to see what you had to say, we're going to head over to Vianne with the audience feedback for this one. Vianne, what is the consensus on this one, and is there a consensus?
Oh, there's a consensus, all right, DK. Just to give you an idea of what it is, Daniel Bushell says, possibly the best movie ever made, with the best soundtrack ever made, and, without a doubt, the best bad guy in any movie, period. So, yeah, that kind of set the tone for the reviews. We had one or two contrarians, such as Alex Clinch here, who said 3 out of 5 with a better director. This had potential to be 5. So even there's the acknowledgement that, you know, of the potential. John Tama, it has Clancy Brown and the soundtrack by Queen, 10 out of 10. And Clancy Brown being in it means that I am going to have to rewatch it because one of my ducklings has a big fat crush on him. And I don't think I remembered that he was in this. So I guess that's going to be coming up for me. Helen Thompson, amazing film, heart the best. Darren James Ahern, it's a 5 from me. Classic story, epic sword fights, amazing soundtrack. Adam Holland, just a gif of a tongue sticking out, bald guy, who I'm pretty sure is from the movie. Gavin Duthie, 6 out of 5. There can be only one. A lot of praise for Clancy Brown. Sam Gordon says, Clancy Brown as the Kurgan, one of the best villains of all time. George, I'm going to butcher your last name, I'm sorry. Chatskosis? Oh, God, that was terrible. George says, a French actor playing a Scottish character and a Scottish actor playing a Spanish character, both retaining their accents while Queen are blasting on top of that. Does not get any better than this. And Declan Kinsella commented on that. Ramirez is Egyptian and only lived in Spain. So thank you for the clarification there. Eric Koskin says, normally I would rate it 4 out of 5, but the soundtrack alone pushes it to 5 out of 5. Christopher Lambert, very underrated actor. Strong 4 from Matthew Ricard. My only gripe is that it drags a little at times. And I think I seem to recall that because I had a friend in middle school who absolutely loved this movie. She had a big crush on one of the guys in it. Wow, that's a theme with my friends in this movie, apparently. And I remember falling asleep. So, yeah, I think I would probably agree that there are moments where it drags. Tommy Walker says, outstanding film. There should be a VR game of it, which is a really interesting idea. Gareth Puckridge, one of my top 10 films, which is saying a lot. And then it's a love fest here in the comments. Lots of 5s, lots of praise for the soundtrack. Angela Pillow, another one of our top contributors. I'd say it was an 8 compared to the sequels. It's a cult classic and there's a huge amount of followers. I love this movie and have the books and DVDs for this movie and the sequels and the TV show. So big hit. A lot of women chiming in on this one, I've noticed, compared to some of our other episodes and film reviews. So I'm glad to see you ladies. Come by more. So let's see. Yeah. It's just a total love fest here, DK. People can't say enough good about it. So taking it back to you now.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks for that, Vianne. Happy holidays, and we'll hopefully see you next season. And again, as always, thank you to you out there. And while we can't read out every bit of feedback for time reasons, we do go through each and every one. I know I'm repeating myself, but we really couldn't do these shows without you, and you've helped Cult Classics so much in this past year, and I doff my metaphorical cap to all of you. So, I think it's safe to say that majority of those that got in touch for today's show loved this one. But is everyone in the studio here in agreement? We'll soon see as we go over to today's guests for their final thoughts and score out of 5 for Highlander. And Gavin, you're up first, buddy, so hit us with that final coup de grace on this one. What's Ooh. Your final thoughts and score out of 5?
Final thoughts. It's a great film that I can keep coming back to and keep seeing little character moments in. And that gives it at least a 4 out of 5 for me. That one.
Cool. And Angela?
This is a much loved film of mine from when I was young. It still is. Despite all the little things that I can pick up now that I'm older, 4 out of 5.
Another 4. Ian?
It's definitely captivates with its original story. The epic battles and now, like, you can see the emotional depth of it, you know, the iconic soundtrack, and it obviously left a lasting legacy as a cult classic. So I would give it probably, you know, I was going to say 4.5 out of 5.
Yeah. No problem. Highlander is, for me, it's one of those gems that prove how much a good, if hulky, script and earnest performances can elevate a production beyond schlock. And a great example of a movie where all those who were working it understood the assignment. It's a B-movie. It knows it's a B-movie. And everyone who worked on it knew it was a B-movie. And yet they all worked their ass off to make it the best damn one-off B-movie they could. And yeah, it may have been a little ramshackle going into it, but the final product is such a great production that it surpasses even its own expectations and led into a legacy that, you know, no matter how dubious, continues to this day. The material is pure pulp fantasy. The effects may show the strings, literally, in places, but the actors breathe life into the project in a way that gives it a feeling of authenticity. It's dumb in places, it's cheesy in places, but you never get the impression that those taking part are treating it as a joke, no matter how tongue-in-cheek it gets. It oozes atmosphere, mythology and ideas, and above all, it's still a fun and entertaining 2 hours. The Highlander name may have been sullied somewhat in the intervening years, but for my money, it's one of the better B-movies to come out of the 80s. And, you know, speaking from personal experience, an example of why physical media is so important. If I had never seen that cover all those years ago, I would have missed out, and I consider myself lucky that that didn't happen. And that's something you just wouldn't get today in today's streaming age. I took a chance, never regretted it, and neither should you. After all, a man should not be afraid of a little boom boom. And I'm going to give it 4.5 out of 5, like Ian, which gives the original Highlander a cult classic score of 4.25 out of 5, which I think that's damn good for what was initially seen as a failure.
That's a fine score.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, we've got a consensus between us here in the studio and even the audience, and that doesn't always happen. It demonstrates just how beloved this thing's become over the years. How about you? You think it's fair enough for this one?
Yeah, definitely.
Yep. I think that's a good reflection of everybody's thoughts and feelings on it, yeah.
And, yeah, that pretty much wraps this up, both for this episode and this season. I'd like to thank my editor, Nick, the good lady, Vianne, and Mike for making this last year possible. And that also goes for the amazing guests who've joined us on the journey this season, present company included. So, yeah, all that's left to do is thank my wonderful guests today and today's episode. So, Angela, thank you for joining us once more.
Thank you for having me.
Is there anything out there that you want to promote?
I've got links to my various Rammstein-related sites. That's about it, really.
What about you, Ian? Thank you for joining us today, mate.
You're welcome.
And is there anything you've got out there that you want to plug while you're here?
Just my own YouTube channel, really. Nothing much. I did release a music video. Links on there.
And last but not least, Gavin, thanks for joining us again, mate.
Yes, no, thank you very much. It's been another pleasant experience.
Nice one. And, you know, again, is there anything that you want to plug while you're here?
No, nothing to plug really particularly that I can think of except more world peace. So, you know, let's just keep pushing at it. It's about the best thing that we can do. Oh, and go and enjoy Highlander as well if you get the chance.
A nice one. Yeah, so as always, we'll put any links from today in the description, so please do check them out if you're so inclined. And that also goes for us here at Silver Screen. If you feel in the holiday spirit and like to contribute to our Ko-fi account, that link's also in the description. As I mentioned earlier, we really couldn't do this show without your support. Like I always say, we don't do this because it's easy. We do it because we thought it would be easy. So thank you to you for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure having you with us. And if you enjoyed this one, then please like, subscribe, tell your friends, check out our previous episodes. And hey, why not join our social media groups if you want to join in the discussion on all things movies? They also give you the heads up on what's coming soon from this channel. So if you had a good time, stick around for future episodes. We've got some good stuff coming up next year. Yeah, so speaking of which, this may be the last you hear from Cult Classics this year, but it's not the final Silver Screen. Mike will be along soon with a couple of holiday-themed episodes in Silver Screen regular flavour in the form of Planes, Trains and Automobiles, personal favourite, and Jingle All the Way. So come and hear us as we discuss those. But if cult movies are more your jam, fear not, we'll be back in the new year with what is rapidly becoming a tradition here at Cult Classics as we open with another epic from the master himself, John Carpenter. And if you're wondering what movie we'll be taking a look at, well, I'll tell you later. Right now I'm too tired. Wink, wink. Until then, take care of yourselves. Have a happy, safe and healthy holiday season. And fingers crossed we'll see you next year. Until then, I have something to say. It's better to burn out than to fade away.
Fade away.
Good night, all.
You have been listening to the Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast, created, written, and hosted by DK. Produced by Mike Wilson. Editing by Nick. Feedback section produced by Lady VN. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.